Dan McNeil, Danny Parkins.
Here we go!
Afternoons on the Score.
And we are thrilled to welcome the perfect guest for Score Stories, the only quarterback to ever win a Super Bowl for the Bears, Jim McMahon on the Score. Jim, how you doing today?
Doing great, guys. How's it going?
Jimmy Mac, I want you to meet my little buddy Danny Parkins, who was conceived during Super Bowl 20.
Thanks, Mac, for the intro.
Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip that started from this tropic void aboard this tiny ship.
You referred to me as something that you've never referred to me before during the interview. I don't know if you thought of this, or do you know what you referred to me as during the interview?
My guy?
Wrong.
Danny, go ahead and play that for Mac.
I want you to meet my little buddy, Danny Parkins.
Oh, am I the skipper from Gilligan's Island? Little buddy.
I always wanted to be a bird.
Well, that shouldn't be hard for you, little buddy. You've got the brain for it.
My little buddy.
My little buddy.
I'm sorry. I didn't even notice that.
Like, I'm just hanging out with you, Dan. Oh, my God. Jimmy Mac, can I please tag me in, coach? I'd like to ask a question now.
I want you to meet my little buddy, Danny Parkins.
Are you ready, little buddy?
Ready.
Mate was a mighty sailor man, skipper brave and sure. Five passengers set sail that day for a three-hour tour. A three-hour tour.
I want you to meet my little buddy, Danny Parkins.
Oh, little buddy, I see exactly what you're trying to do.
Hey, buddy.
My buddy.
My little buddy.
My buddy.
My buddy.
My little buddy.
My buddy and me.
My little buddy, Danny Parkins.
My buddy from Hasbro Preschool.
Hey, buddy.
Yo! Saddle up! Lock and load!
The McNeil and Parkins Show. Afternoons 2 to 6 on 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago's sports station.
Thanks for hanging out. It's Mac and his little buddy on The Score. I love it. Although I just got validated by Dave Wonstead. Boy Wonder did a great job. So, you know, I can only assume, Mac, that Tanny will give that the open treatment tomorrow. You know, if he does the one calling me a little buddy, he's going to do the one calling me an A-lister or whatever he did before.
You know, you steer the Tanny man in a direction, and he could steer it completely the other way just to defy you.
It's gonna backfire. I know. I certainly know that it will. Well, he got me good when I completely lost track of time last hour.
Why don't we discuss it during the break?
I'm a professional broadcaster.
Let's mull it during these
Let's
commercials.
Let's pay off that tease, shall we?
Let's do it. Thanks, Danny.
Remember
That's
that?
How we do it. Trevor Plouffe.
Plouffe.
He says on the old Twitter box, "Want some good baseball news? I just heard from multiple sources that June 10th is going to be spring training 2, and July 1st will be opening day, and all teams will be playing at their home ballparks." Mac, my initial thought is that is not a story that is going to be broken by Trevor Plouffe, but it is in line with the most recent thing being reported by Bob Nightingale for baseball by 4th of July weekend. So it's possible that Trevor Plouffe is hearing what is the current plan, but I'd be really, really surprised if that was already etched in stone, given that June 10th is a long way from May 4th.
Yeah, who knows? By the time it gets to somebody, the story has been twisted and turned, and he assumes it to be reality and goes online and makes it public, and maybe there's nothing to it. I'm certain there have been conversations about getting it started early in July, but that doesn't mean it's on go, which is what he's implying with his tweet today, and that's not the case. When Rob Manfred says we've got this targeted for spring training 2, that's when we can expect baseball teams to report to their training camps, wherever those may be.
Yeah, it just doesn't seem like the type of story that this guy is going to break. And he's getting into media. He's got a baseball podcast and an online show. And, you know, obviously he's got more sources within the game than I do. But it just, if Trevor Plouffe had heard this, we'd have 50 other baseball players rushing to social media who had heard the same thing, right? It's not like they're going to just alert him.
No, probably not. I don't think he would be. Who should we get to leak this to? Find me a Plouffe. He'll
be weird.
It.
Like, Ian Happ would be talking about it on his podcast that he's talking about with Bernstein every week. Like, there's plenty of baseball play. Trevor Bauer seems to be fairly outspoken on social
right.
media.
Yeah.
There's lots of guys that if they had this information would be rushing in to confirm it and share it and grow their social platform as well. So something tells me this story is going to be denied or at least further reported on, maybe even by the time we get off the air, by a Nightingale or a Rosenthal or a Passan.
That probably is the case. Maybe baseball itself will say something, no truth to these rumors. Look, I'm looking forward to sports returning. I'm not going to say as much as everybody else because that's an exaggeration. I'm looking forward to it returning, but I'm hoping people exercise their smarts here and not rush back to normalcy if it isn't time yet. And that's been my stance since before we were separated and started doing these broadcasts from home. This is week 7 of all of us working at home, and I have felt this way from the word go. When the CDC says it's okay, that's when people should start making plans. You make your plans for now. Yeah, go ahead, make those plans. But nothing is on go until smarter people than we are say it's time to step on go. It's not
Scorehouse.
Oh, no, I thought of that too. Do we have another Scorehouse? No, no more.
What do you mean no more? No more this year. We
no
don't go to Scorehouse.
Year, right. We're not going to do another one this year.
It'd be a real power move.
Oh, goodness.
Everyone has their own room. They
yeah,
have to stay
that's
in
that's
because
everyone's going to have their own show by the time we get to the
That's possible. Yeah, so spring training 2, so we do Scorehouse 2.0, social distancing style. It would not be nearly as fun, but it's something to consider. Let's get.
You know, The Athletic put out that 2022 Cubs opening day piece. Did you see that?
So yes.
Yeah, it was part of that. And I didn't read anything about Scorehouse in there, so I hate to break it to you guys. Not part of
it's
the
all
plans.
Over. Sahadev, normally so thorough in his reporting, but he just left out that detail of what it would be like in the lead up to opening day of 2022.
Surprising too, since he was a visitor at Scorehouse too. He stopped by for a little while to enjoy
That's
life
true.
With us for a little bit.
Scorehouse.
Dun, 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 and his skin looks so very soft. Yeah, he's a good looking man.
Yes, absolutely. It's a different time, Mac, of Scorehouse. It feels like a lifetime ago. Doesn't it?
Yeah.
That feels like it was 8 years ago instead of 8 weeks.
Right? We should be in the, fifth, sixth week of the baseball season at this point, and it's nowhere in sight, and it's nice to think about a summer that will include some. But I hope people don't react silly and don't put themselves in danger. There's, you know, the
texter says the ploof is in the pudding. It's in the bread pudding.
The ploof
is in the bread.
It sounds
pudding.
Like a bodily function, doesn't it?
The bread. What it is? The bread is in the pudding. Whatever they say.
Eat the bread from the pudding, and you'll ploof.
Yeah. It does. It sounds like gas
ploofed.
Would follow. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly, out of some sort of orifice on her back.
Some sort of.
Fill in your orifice. Orifice draft.
Goodness. Oh, no.
No, don't do that. It's a terrible
idea. Your mind. Yeah, that's really
What a draft.
Right after the jump to conclusions, Matt.
Yeah, it's
he
a terrible
designed
idea.
The prospects for an orifice.
It's the worst idea I've ever heard. Truly horrible. That and the pet rock. Yeah. Speaking of a weird idea, I love gambling. Breaking news, I know. Loved the Jordan documentary last night. Ton of gambling conversation. Ton of gambling footage. I enjoyed gambling. I had never seen that game that he was playing with the security guards, and then I Googled it, pitching pennies. They were playing with quarters, but I was unaware of pitching pennies. It apparently was an event in the first Olympics, and it was too boring, so they took it out, but that is where the gold medal came from. throw a coin towards a wall, closest coin to the wall wins from an agreed-upon distance away.
Yeah.
How have I never known about pitching pennies before?
Haven't you seen, I always want to call it pinching pennies too, but it is pitching pennies. Haven't you seen A Bronx Tale? With Chaz Palminteri?
Really?
That's where the scene, what is it? Help me with that, Tanny. You know it better than I do. The scene where you get mooshed, is that what they call it?
Mushed.
Mushed.
Yeah, because the guy.
Yeah,
the
you're
guy,
a mush.
You're
yeah.
a mush, because there's a guy mushes in his name, and they make
Eddie,
him
Eddie
go
mush,
in the bathroom.
I think, yeah.
Yeah, they make him, they lock him. Chaz Palminteri locks him in the bathroom.
Mac, you know about Eddie Mush, they used to give his tickets from the dog track already ripped up. That's right.
Yeah. They're pitching pennies in that scene. That's when the kid makes his first bet, right?
All right. Yeah, no, excellent point. Should have known the reference from that. I just didn't know the phrase of it. I don't know. I was stuck by this, and I'm like, man, Michael Jordan will really gamble on anything. Is that a thing that is made up? And then I started looking into it. Not a thing that is made up. Well before Michael Jordan, pitching pennies had come around. You know, like ancient Greeks. It's one of the first things ever gambled on in civilization. I love that.
Yeah.
I have a competition problem.
He does have a competition problem. It's fun, actually. I remember doing it in grade school until the big bust of 1973 when I was one of a dozen or maybe 18 kids implicated in a penny pitching scandal and was convicted, got swatted, and my parents grounded me. And what it precluded me from was a chance to see the Chicago Cubs traveling all-star basketball team play the Highland High School faculty in my hometown on a Friday night. The call came to my parents in the middle of the day. He's one of a bunch of kids got caught pitching quarters. He got swats. We just wanted to inform you that your son's been gambling at school. So my parents, they ground me. I can't go see Glenn Beckert and Kenny Holtzman and Fergie Jenkins take on the Highland High faculty. I was crushed. I was in sixth grade. I was devastated by that, and I don't think I've pitched a quarter since. But I was good at it, too. I was taking all the money.
That's what I was going to say. So you were good at pitching quarters, pitching pennies.
I was. Right, I was one of the – I would go home with a lot of silver in my pocket almost every day. So I was devastated when the bus came down.
Was that your first experience with gambling? Because my first time gambling, my great-grandmother – taught me how to play poker when I was like 5 years old with her change collection as the chips. We would like sit around, me and my other cousins, and she would teach us poker, five card draw at, you know, I was 5 years old. There's a great picture of me playing cards. So that was my first exposure to gambling. Was pitching pennies your first exposure to it?
No, I gambled on Super Bowl III. Don Shula and the Colts came up short. I lost a quarter.
R.I.P.
I was eight. I have to apologize. They are not pitching pennies in A Bronx Tale. They are
they're
throwing
shooting,
dice.
It's a dice
they're throwing
game.
Dice. Okay. I've only seen the movie once or twice. I thought they were pitching quarters. I apologize. Thank you for the many texters who sent to correct me. I hope you weren't driving.
Makes me feel a little bit better about the reference, but I've only seen the movie once as well, and it was a long, long time ago, so I wasn't gonna call you out on it. But yeah, I'd never seen
the deleted scene that Mac was talking about.
Oh, yeah, the pitching penny scene. He goes deep on the DVD walk-up of A Bronx Tale that he's seen the one time. But yeah, I loved it last night. Jordan gambling with the security guards for $20 and then comping them to Jerry Krause.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what fueled him. You know, the one thing, and we've talked about the documentary at length today, one thing we have not talked about, and we were not critical of him for not taking a political viewpoint. That's up to him. We said we were not critical of him for gambling because we don't know. That's what I said. I don't know what his behavior becomes if he's on a losing streak. Something I would criticize him for, I thought the American flag draped over the shoulder to cover the shoe company logo was low rent. That wasn't about your shoe company. That was about the shoe company that was endorsing your team and your country. And I had a problem with that. I thought it was just what I described it as. I thought it was a low rent move. I don't think you cover the sponsor of your team. It's not about you in that case. It's about the team, and that was the sponsor. Reebok was the sponsor of the Dream Team. And for one day, you could have worn that and not made a scene about it.
He definitely could have. We know that Mike made it about himself often, and that footage of him saying that guy was an a-hole from Reebok and all of that was pretty good. And so, yeah, an iconic picture for Jordan all those years later. And, you know, I thought the shoe recruiting story was interesting. I don't want it to be characterized for me in terms of not being critical of him about the endorsement thing or in terms of the activism stuff. I would have loved it, but he wasn't doing it for me. Like, I understand why so many black people and were disappointed that he didn't take a stand when he was asked to on something that seemed so obvious, and he just chose another way to do it in terms of like his hiring practices with the Hornets and his hiring practices with Jordan Brand and some of his donations politically with his money doing the talking instead of his words. Because like I said earlier, there were so many African-American athletes where it wasn't fair. But like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Jim Brown, Muhammad Ali, Arthur Ashe, Jackie Robinson, like they weren't being asked of the white athletes to do that, but it was like this thing that, hey, you are being accepted by mainstream white America, so advocate for us who are not being accepted in the same way that you are because of your extraordinary talents. So I totally get the criticism. It's just that was not something that Michael felt that he was able to do. And in that one in particular, I do think the Republicans buy sneakers too. Why it was compelling was A, he admitted to it. Whereas up like 4 years ago, there's stuff where his camp was denying that he had ever even said it in the first place.
Right.
So I thought it was compelling. And then the other part of it that just I do think should be mentioned from where his head was that was before he had won a title. And he had that singular focus of being the best basketball player in the world. I don't know if you stayed and watched the Scott Van Pelt Sports Center, but he's basically doing post-game shows for this documentary, and he had Barkley on, and Barkley said, Jordan and Tiger Woods, the two athletes that he has seen in his lifetime that had the most singular focus towards greatness. Like, Barkley worked hard, cared about greatness, but also cares about media and being an entertainer and loved food and loved gambling and golf and other things. Like, Jordan had this like singular track mind. The money and the endorsements were a byproduct of the dominance on the court. And so I do think it's worth noting that Michael Jordan hosting a $20,000 a plate fundraiser for Barack Obama in 2012 after his career, donating to Democratic candidates every year that political finance records go back to 1996. Like, he let his money do the talking before he was actually willing to do the talking. But when this story about the North Carolina Senate race, even if it seems so unbelievably obvious who you should endorse, right? He hadn't even accomplished accomplished his main goal yet. So in the context of that time, it seems so easy now. In that time, I think it was a lot tougher.
Obvious, yes, unless you are a raging racist, and then it's not so obvious. And then Jesse's
correct.
Your man. And what in the world would he endorse that guy for? Are you kidding me, Gav?
Would have been interesting, though, to hear Jordan say, my mom was right and I was wrong. Because he wasn't willing to go that far.
Right.
Like
He
you
made
know?
A campaign donation, and that's as far as he wanted to go. And that was probably to make mom happy because he hates parting with his money. We know that to be true.
Right. And the story in The Undefeated today said that they couldn't find records of the donation at that point. He made a donation in 96 when Gant ran again for a mayoral race, I believe it was, in Charlotte. But there wasn't any record of it from then. Doesn't mean it didn't happen, but just The Undefeated's reporting on it wasn't able to uncover it. But I thought that was just a poignant moment in the documentary because given that he's basically a co-executive producer of this thing that he had to sign off on it on, you never know what they're going to sign off. And I ever since Ken Burns' criticism of it, I've been thinking about it more through that journalistic lens. That's not what this is. This is entertainment. Like, if Jordan has the rights to the footage and Jordan said kids off limits, first wife off limits, it's not journalism. It's entertainment, and that's totally
journalism-ish fine. Because it's littered with fact. It is littered with facts. Yeah, they're chronicling a decade plus of the Chicago Bulls and Michael Jordan. So the fact that it happened, it's historic. To a degree, it's journalism. That's probably not the objective. The mission statement is to entertain and get a lot of people to watch it, and they were very fortunate of the timing when they were getting ready to release this thing and then amped it up when they realized that America didn't have anything else to watch and the president is tired of watching 14-year-old baseball games, so give him something that he might want to sit down and watch, and that is let him relive the 90s Bulls.
A clip that you pulled for it that you said was sticking out to you, we've got to play coming up because I think it kind of embodies the entire 10-part documentary. It's next on The Score.
Similarity between the Bulls and Seinfeld, the show of the 90s, the team of the 90s, and I'm trying to make quitting the move of the 90s. Let the new people in.
How you doing?
Good to see you.
Haven't seen you since the photo set. These are a couple of your good fans right here. Every day we come in and watch a game, they're watching your show. Not saying sooner or later you got to get tired of Seinfeld.
Let's go, guys.
Hi, Phil.
How you doing?
All right. All right, have a good game.
Principal's kicking you out.
Good to see you.
All right, I see you, dude.
All right. This is not going to work, by the way. How we get that out of there?
Just keep the bottom mic on it.
How you doing?
All right.
Have a good game.
This segment on The Score brought to you by Grand Appliance and TV. Gotta be honest, I enjoyed very much seeing Jerry Seinfeld last night. Oh, let me do the second half of this read. Grand Appliance has served Chicagoland since 1930 and remains committed to safely delivering and installing your essential appliances during these unprecedented times. Shop in-store, over the phone, or at grandappliance.com and get an additional 5% rebate on most appliance purchases. Did you have a favorite celebrity sighting last night, Mac?
He was right, by the way. Show of the 90s and the team of the 90s, and I don't think that can be disputed. Third down, 9 yards to go. Yeah, who's going to argue with that? No, nobody, right?
No one would.
I wouldn't. I'm not my favorite show, but it was the show of the 90s. I would say
yeah,
NYPD
75
Blue,
million
probably.
People for yeah. the yes. finale.
Yes, it made a dent.
Yeah, I would say it was definitely the show of the 90s.
Michael Jordan saying that some players might actually get sick of watching Seinfeld. Man, we'll have to retract that statement in the next episode, maybe. That's a bad look for MJ.
Yeah.
No one could get sick of Seinfeld.
My 20-year-old kids who were, barely were still in diapers when the show was on the air are watching it. They love it. Two of them, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think Curb Your Enthusiasm has passed it, but the difficulty of doing that show and covering some of the topics that they did, given that they were doing 22-episode seasons within the constraints of network TV, is a fairly remarkable comedic achievement.
Yep.
An iconic show, whether it's your brand of comedy or not, what they were able to do was absolutely insane. But you picked out this quote from Jerry Krause, and I'm a little surprised it took this long into the documentary for us to hear it, because I think it's basically the crux of the issue of why this whole thing called The Last Dance ended up happening.
The one thing I would say, and I'd say it from Jerry Reinsdorf on down, this is a great organization. This organization is special. From Jerry, it starts with Jerry and it goes down all the way to Joe Lee, our clubhouse guy who's been here 25 years. It's an organization thing, and that's what it's all about. The team is a great team, but the organization is one of the all-time great, if not the greatest organization ever. That's what I'm so much proud of.
You smoking a cigar?
You can't smoke it. It's Dutch Bros.
Wow, that's about a 22-second soundbite right after they beat Portland in the 92 finals, and he's singing the praises of the Bulls as an organization and not the players, not Phil Jackson and his assistants. He's just touting that organizational, man, that's trouble.
Well, it's one thing to say, thank you to Jerry Reinsdorf for being a great owner of a sports team who's invested in giving us everything that we need to win, right? You hear that on the podium at these championship ceremonies all the time. That is very – right? I want to thank the Rooney family. I want to thank the Mara family, whatever the case may be. You hear that all the time. But clearly, from the beginning, Jerry Krause had an issue with regards to credit and wanting the accomplishments of the players to be more spread evenly in terms of the praise among other members of the organization. And Michael Jordan, if, again, we've learned anything from this documentary, he's not so keen on anyone else getting any credit.
Well, he probably would have been fine if some teammates got some, and there were some who deserved it. Unlike the first title, the year that preceded the win over Portland, you had contributions from Bobby Hansen. Scottie Pippen had a better NBA Finals the second time around. That was much more of a team-based series win, postseason win, than the first one was. That timing was terrible. You just won the championship, and man, it just, I understand it. I don't agree with the way Jordan and some others treated Krause, but I understand why they had such a strong distaste and disdain for him over the years. That's earned.
Well, and I'll be honest with you, like, as someone who obviously remembers the second three-peat, but through the eyes of a child, and then as just a diehard fan and then someone who got into this industry, has gone back and like read four or five books about Michael Jordan and the 90s Bulls and owned the DVDs of the championship seasons, right? Like, all of this information isn't new to me, though some of it certainly is, but the timeline of it, I guess they're doing a very good job of trying to put it into context of when it happened. It's kind of amazing that in 92, right, they've won a second title, Jordan's going off to play with the Dream Team, and Jerry Krause is talking about Tony Kukoc as being a savior of the Bulls.
Yep.
When they've won back-to-back titles, like acting like they need a savior, and a second-round pick from 2 years ago is going to modernize and revolutionize a Bulls team that is in the literal process of modernizing and revolutionizing not only the team, but the entire league. And then in 96, they haven't even won the fourth championship yet, and he's openly flirting with Tim Floyd in Seattle about replacing Phil Jackson. Like, if that they could have derailed the entire second three-peat if that happens and Jordan forces his way out because he doesn't want to be coached by anyone other than Phil. Like, Jerry Krause was often nothing but bad timing. Even though he did a lot of amazing things, the timing of what he did was just baffling.
Yeah, it is. Then the more this thing evolves, to me, the more this falls on the owner for allowing it to happen, for not choosing the best talent on the floor over a general manager who, you know, apparently they weren't very close. I was led to believe at the time they were closer than what Sam Smith reported to us a few weeks ago. I thought they were much more birds of a feather than what Sam painted, but yeah, Jerry had the opportunity. You know, when Krause says, you know, we go 82-0, we're gonna have a different coach, that the owner can come in and say, look, enough. I want this guy. If he wanted him, now maybe Reinsdorf was put off by Jackson as well. I don't know. It would stand to reason to me, you would want to make a run at a seventh championship when you just won your third straight for the second time. Yeah, they're getting older, and sooner or later you got to retool. But when you're a great champion, when you're one of the greatest champions in league history and you have a bona fide dynasty, you're going to let a personality conflict between coach GM, players GM, force all of the rank and file out, and that GM keeps his job? No, he got it wrong. I think he got it wrong. I think he should have shown Jerry the door, or at least found a buffer system between the players and maybe reassign Krause to something else. Krause was a good general manager. I've never said anything but that. But Jerry Reinsdorf should have done something instead of just sit there and let this thing all decay right before his very eyes.
He should have. I agree with you. What is interesting is, in hindsight, it might have actually been a thing that was helpful to Jordan's legacy, because when people discuss greatest of all time, the number one thing that people go to for Mike was 6-0 in the finals. Whereas LeBron, right, 3-6 in the finals. And it's that's always been a weird piece of calculus to me, because it's like, so making it six times and never losing is better than making it more times and losing. It's like Jordan gets rewarded in that debate for losing in the playoffs before making it to the finals, whereas LeBron gets penalized for making it there. So it's like, I wonder if they go back and they lose in whatever, 99, 2000.
What would Jordan have been in 99? 37? 38? So even if you get to the finals and lose, that's still a skin on the wall that you get to your – I know what you're saying. You certainly don't want to have a losing record, but 6-1 looks pretty good. 6-1 looks a lot better than 3-6. Call me nuts.
Of course. He was 34 – in 97-98.
Oh, 34? I thought he was a few years older than that. I thought he was 36.
He didn't play when he was 35, 36, 37, and then he played for the Wizards at 38 and 39.
Yeah.
But still, it's just weird how it all happened, how it all went down. Like, the idea, and I thought that was maybe the best part of the episode last night, was the burden of the fame and the pressure and the attention of being Michael Jordan, a guy who seemingly handled it as close to perfectly as possible, only had the solitude of a hotel room, right? It was this weird thing. He did all the commercials. He had two Trey as his license plate. He had 23 on the gate of his home. Like, this wasn't a man who was trying to hide, who was trying to be out of the public eye, but walked away from the game twice when he was absolutely still in his prime, right? He led the league in scoring in 97-98 and played in all 82 games. Like, this was a man who was at the absolute peak of his powers, even if his efficiency numbers were a little down. He was still the best player in the sport, and he left because the pressure of it and the organizational circumstances. And so I don't know that he would have won again in 98-99. You don't know if he would have won if he would have played against that Rockets team and had to do 8 straight years in the finals without ever stepping aside. His career obviously played out how it was supposed to, but I thought like the burden of fame finally got illustrated in the episodes last night.
Yeah, great little piece of the first episode, I thought, last night too, when they were showing a photo shoot for the Dream Team when it was the three guys who made the NBA in the 80s and took it out of it being a garage league, is what it was, like a garage band league. And that's Bird, Magic, and Jordan. And Johnson is standing behind Jordan. He said, "I can't stand this close. They'll call a foul."
"You can't get too close to Michael. It's a foul."
"You haven't committed a foul in almost a year and a half, man. How can you talk?" "My goodness. I don't think you ever found out of a game. When do you ever find out of a game?"
"I'm the young guy with the elder statesman."
The funny thing is Magic saying that too, because when Magic came in the league, he was the original wine to the refs. He was the first, at least that I remember, to go through all the gesticulating and the palms up, look, you know, wide-eyed. Where's the call on this? So Magic benefited from a little star treatment along the way also. But when he's calling out Jordan, that's when you know the guy doesn't get called.
That is absolutely right. And that Dream Team footage was awesome, man.
Yeah, it was cool.
The practice. Like,
oh, yeah.
So good. So good. And how about the idea of that bus ride being tense for a couple of moments because it got too competitive, and them actually being like, "Oh, that was a little uncomfortable."
Yeah, they
were
ripped.
Breaking the tension.
Yeah, they were absolutely gassed from a scrimmage, and Jordan took over the scrimmage and gained a, you know, that was a remarkable little piece of behind the scenes stuff. I enjoyed that. And Rod Thorne, who drafted Jordan, did a lot of the commentary on that, and I enjoyed that as well.
You mentioned Reinsdorf. I hope we see him as the documentary goes on again. Like, not only to be a voice for Jerry Krause, but if this thing is going to end with them breaking it up, So he was very prevalent or very present in the first couple of episodes. I hope Jerry Reinsdorf is back in this documentary at the end, because you got to speak to and have some ownership over why this thing ended when it did. So I assume he will be, as he sat down for the interview, but he has been notably absent from the last few episodes. We'll put a bow on this thing with a story that I'm proud we didn't go too deep on really at all today. Next on The Score.
Remember the 89 Super Bowl?
49ers Bengals. Niners down by 3:20 left in the game. 93-yard winning drive. Taylor beats the weak safety for a 10-yard TD.
Joe Montana's in the huddle, right? And unbelievably, somehow spots the actor John Candy in the stands and points at him and asks the guys in the huddle, "Hey, isn't that John Candy?" Couldn't believe the balls on him to be that calm in that game at that moment. His guys instantly relax. They march
93 yards.
93 yards. Montana throws a little slant to Taylor. 49ers win the Super Bowl. No one can stop a ticking clock, but the great ones always find a way to slow it down.
The iconic film, Draft Day.
It's beautifully put.
Now I'm torn.
Over.
I was going to watch A Bronx Tale so I can quote it a little bit more accurately the next time I go to the Bronx Tale file. But now, after hearing Sonny Weaver describe Super Bowl 23, oh, man.
Or not. I
may have to give that a spin.
I mean, you got to watch. When you have an opportunity to see Draft Day for the 15th time.
Yeah, I'm going to watch A Bronx Tale. I need to watch it. If I thought they were pitching pennies or pitching quarters and not playing dice, I have to get it right. I'm going to watch A Bronx Tale tonight.
Okay.
All right, I'll get it right.
I'm glad that's settled. The Doug Buffone tribute show is coming up in just a little bit. We did not discuss the Bears declining Mitch Trubisky's fifth-year option on today's show. That was not by design. It just kind of happened that way. But I think in a lot of ways it's appropriate. It's a non-story. It was obvious that this was going to be what they were going to do for a long, long time. And now everybody is coming around and saying, like, oh, what would you expect? Don't expect anything else, of course. There was debate about this. There was Absolutely. Debate about Mitch being the starter and the fifth-year option and all of that. But actions over words led us on this show to be discussing for months that this was what was going to happen. And so, you know, we'll make you football smarter.
There,
2-6, Mac.
Yeah, that's is that the goal? That's true. We did debate it, and there once you know people had it explained to them, and I needed a refresher on it at the time as well. That it's not a guaranteed contract. Everybody settled down. The only thing that would make the Bears on the hook for all of the contract would be an injury. So once everybody was educated on it, people calmed down and said, okay, even if they do, they can still cut him if they find a better option.
Yeah, but there's no reason. He didn't earn it. They traded a fourth-round pick for Nick Foles. Nick Foles knows the system. Nick Foles has flashed a higher ceiling than Mitch Trubisky. And if, in some crazy, unforeseen circumstance, Mitch Trubisky wins the job and balls out, or Nick Foles gets the job, gets hurt, and then Mitch comes in and then balls out, he's either you franchise tag him, or he's a restricted free agent like Kyle right. Fuller, and you can match an offer if you choose to do so. So he's not going to be great, but if he turns out to be great, the Bears can still retain his services. So this was the move all along. It was a mere formality that finally happened over the weekend. You're watching A Bronx Tale. I am watching Billions and Last Week Tonight with John Oliver and stretching my hamstrings, which are very sore from my round of golf.
Yeah, this crew needs an Epsom salt bath.
I bought some today, actually. Yeah, it's going to happen. It's a little embarrassing for a 33-year-old to be looking forward to a bath as much as I am, but, you know. You got to do it, Mac. Let's see here. Thank you to Herb Lawrence back in the Score studios helping us out throughout all of these Scorantine broadcasts. Nick Shepkowski is our executive producer. The guests on today's show, Joe Klein from the 97-98 Bulls, and our friend Dave Wanstead. Chris Tannehill makes us sound better than we are each and every day. For Dan McNeil, I'm Danny Parkins. We are McNeil and Parkins. The Doug Buffone tribute coming up next. This is The Score.
That'll basically be the show because we don't have much time for anything else.